Mark Steele Revolution, a series of lectures on revolution. This week, the Industrial Revolution.
What was it like in the Industrial Revolution? Well, some people say that the times we're living in now are very similar to then, because, well, computers are changing everything, man. With computers, they say, we'll soon be all working from home. But this is rubbish. What about dustmen, then? We're going to stand outside their house with a huge dustpan and brush and a long bit of elastic. And it's not enough for these people now to have a word processor. Nah, that makes you anti-technology. Everyone's supposed to have a modern Microsofty Gates Windows thing with purple fish going backwards and forwards across it. And then people say, yeah, but like you can do a pie chart on an Apple Mac. Oh, well, that's what every household needs above all else is a pie chart, isn't it? And you can come running through the house going, guess what? 11% of the area of this house is the kitchen. On the other hand, during the Industrial Revolution, what most people meant by time or money or work was completely transformed. In 1770, England made clothes with £5 million of cotton. In 1830, with £528 million of cotton. In 1770, the quickest way from Birmingham to London was by stagecoach and took 16 hours. Whereas by 1845, a train did it in 2.5 hours, which is incredible when you think that the next dramatic change wasn't until the 1990s when Richard Branson took it back to 16 again. And agriculture. Today it's considered a scary scientific advance that they can clone a sheep, when to me the whole point of a sheep is that they're all identical. Like, will there ever be anyone who walks past a field and goes, hang on. That one fifth from the left is uncannily similar to the one in the top right. But during the Industrial Revolution, advances in farming meant that the average size of a sheep doubled. In 1770, hardly anybody had heard of a factory. By 1830, millions of people worked in one. So why did it happen? Well, one theory from a book currently used in schools called The Industrial Revolution puts it down to a change in demand. For example, the sudden growth of the potteries founded by Josiah Wedgwood in the Stoke area is explained as,
in the early 18th century, the drinking habits of the British people were changing. Instead of drinking out of leather or wooden mugs, people began to drink tea, coffee and chocolate. They needed cups, saucers, teapots and milk jugs.
So how did that happen then?
Hello, Jack. What thou having?
Hey, do you know, Martha, I'm right fed up with ale. Hast thou any coffee?
Do you know, Jack, thou's 10th person today to ask that? After hundreds of years of folk from Stoke area being satisfied with ale, suddenly everyone wants coffee.
Aye. And I've always said you can't enjoy coffee without separate jug for milk.
Aye. But with no such thing as milk jug in existence, you buggered, I shouldn't wonder.
And then years later, after the Industrial Revolution.
Good old Wedgwood. A cup with saucer and separate jug. Just a shame, really, that I got silicosis from clay dust in his factory and haven't energy to pick bugger up.
If the Industrial Revolution was just a response to people demanding more things, why did it only happen in Britain? I mean, you'd think the French would be well up for an idea that doubled the size of sheep. Same number, twice as a bonfire. In this programme, I'm going to argue that the Industrial Revolution wasn't at all brought about by a few great British geniuses. And that, in fact, most of the famous inventors of the time were, in truth, not very good, or frauds or nutcases. And also that one of the most forward-looking and progressive groups of the whole period was the Luddites. Now, the first problem that a society has to overcome if it's going to industrialise is how it's going to get people to work in the mills and factories. Now, this couldn't have happened without the enclosures. Up until the 1500s, most people who neither owned or could rent land were entitled to use what was known as common land, on which anybody could grow food or take firewood or scrape a living. But in the 15th century, wool became hugely profitable, so land made more money with sheep grazing on it than with people living on it. So wool became like property was in the 1980s.
Forsooth, barman. Tell if you what, sire, great day on the markets. Boughteth 200 units of finest sheep at 45, soldeth at 62, and cleareth the uncouth peasants out of Docklands for some more wool development. I'll have a bottle of mead with some lime in the top.
In response to this demand for wool, the landowners illegally enclosed areas of common land, leaving those who owned no land with no rights. Gradually, people drifted into the towns, where if they couldn't find work, they had to beg. So Henry VIII passed a law that went,
"Sturdy vagabonds to be tied to the cart tail and whipped until the blood streams from their bodies, then to swear an oath to put themselves to labour."
That last sentence sounds strangely familiar, doesn't it? I wonder if Henry went on Radio 4 that day and said,
"Look, we have to offereth beggars an opportunity out of vagabondage and back to labour. And the cart-tail to work scheme offers exactly that." But look, the choices we have to maketh must be tough.
Then in the 17th century came a whole series of advances in agriculture. Farmers discovered that the quality of land improved if, instead of leaving it to rest every fourth year, as they had been doing, they planted turnips in it. For a while, England went turnip crazy. People grew turnips wherever there was space for them. An archdeacon had to reprimand a rector for growing turnips in a graveyard, saying,
"This must not occur again."
To which the rector was reported as replying,
"Oh, no, sir. Next year it will be barley."
So all around the playgrounds of Britain, schoolgirls were probably going, "Here, who's your favourite turnip? I like baby turnip."
"Yeah. Nah, scary turnip's got kicking air and won't let no one boil her, yeah."
And posh turnip's getting married to another vegetable. A few years later, a landowner from Norfolk claimed that the idea was his about the turnips, and he hired himself out to speak under the name of Turnip Townsend. And Turnip Townsend is credited with the discovery of the value of the turnip in most schoolbooks on the period. But in fact, at the time that turnips were first introduced to East Anglia, Turnip Townsend was only 6 years old. So not only was he a liar, but presumably it was because that he was a lord that everybody else had to go along with it. He'd probably been speaking at these meetings about bringing the first turnips from Europe, and people would have been clapping and thinking, "Oh, I remember putting the buggers in a stew when he was only six." I bet if he hadn't been a lord, social services would have sent someone round to say, "Look, I'm afraid you're suffering from what's known as false turnip syndrome." By the middle of the 18th century, one farmer could grow four or five times as much from a piece of land as he could have done 100 years earlier. So with less people needed to look after land, a second wave of enclosures began. Now, during the Industrial Revolution, 3,280 bills were passed by Parliament, enclosing almost the whole of Britain. Now, there were several other factors in Britain's favour which helped stimulate the Industrial Revolution. First, there were enough individuals with sufficient wealth that they could invest in projects like the canal system. And where that wealth mostly came from was slavery. Planters in the West Indies often invested their money back in England. And owners of Liverpool slave ships recorded profits of up to 150% on their investments. And I bet they still went round going, "Here, we may only be slave trading millionaires, right, but at least we can have a good laugh." But Britain's empire also ensured that the stuff they were going to be making in industry had a market. Once the Napoleonic War started, European armies became a major customer for clothes. Isambard Kingdom Brunel made his fortune out of naval contracts. And Wilkinson made his wealth as an ironmaker out of supplying cannon to the Navy. I wonder if at the start Wilkinson had an advert that went,
"Many cannon can penetrate the hull of a frigate, but with the Wilkinson twin cannon technique, the first cannon brings an extra crowd of French sailors to the surface who gather to look at the hole, then the second cannon comes in to finish them off, drowning the entire crew to leave a smoother naval victory."
Britain's naval dominance allowed it to visit anywhere in the world, forcing other governments to accept British trade. And a growing market was also provided by the increase in population, which in the period went from 5 million to 14 million. So at this point, even modest inventions could transform the country. And even these came about as modifications of other ideas, and not from sudden strokes of genius, like they tell you at school or on Blue Peter.
"Today we're going to learn how the steam engine was invented. One day, a young Scotsman called James Watt was boiling a kettle to make some steaming hot porridge. When all of a sudden..."
"Hey, Mother, will you look at that?"
James, dear. There's nothing but steam.
Hey, but if I put your hand on it, what happens then? That's right, you jolt your hand upwards. Now just suppose that instead of your hand, there was a series of pistons. Would that not be sufficient to propel a wee engine there?
Also, the impression you get about the steam engine is that it was always a wonderful, quaint object invented to get people to places. As if the day Watt invented it, he put a sign up saying, "Come and visit ye oldie steam train." And loads of old blokes in cloth caps turned up going, "Look at that little beauty, takes me back." In truth, it was probably the other way round, with blokes huddled together on platforms going,
"Spotting these things will never be as much fun as horse and cart spotting." "I saw the 346986X pass through Crewe on Monday."
"Was that the one with the short mane and the gammy leg?"
"Yeah, that's the one, yeah."
But the steam train was designed to move coal, not people. And that's the reason why the first railway in Britain was in the coalfield from Stockton to Darlington. And not because the railway company thought, "I know what'll make a good away day trip for the people of Stockton. A trip to Darlington." But all things, of course, are relative, and so it's true that Watt's steam engine relied on physics which had been around for 100 years. Cornish tin mines already used a basic steam engine which had been invented 70 years earlier by a man called Savary. The French were considered to be ahead of the British in science, and their Jacquard loom, invented in 1804, was more complex than anything invented at the time in Britain. The Prussian Berg Academy was respected as the finest technical training institution in Europe. Far from industrialisation being the result of a handful of great British geniuses, the inventions that revolutionised cotton, the flying shuttle, the spinning jenny and the mule were just modifications of existing machinery. What the inventions of the 18th century made possible was to make the same things as before, but hundreds of times faster. So they changed people's lives by transforming the way that they worked. Up until then, most craftsmen either worked at home on their own machine, like a loom, or if they didn't own one themselves, then they worked on a neighbour's machine. Once a week, a merchant would buy what they'd made, probably at the local market, so that the craftsman knew that as long as he got the job done, he could work when he liked. Which meant that they were like students. You know the way a student will say, "Oh, no, I've got to start work with this 10,000-word essay in a minute. It's got to be handed in tomorrow morning." "Oh, that's tough. When did they give you that to do?" "Oh, a year ago last April." In reality, the craftsmen did work long hours, but they had a sense of control over what they were doing. The whole family, including young kids, would be involved in the work, but if they wanted to stop for half an hour and go for a walk, they could. And for craftsmen in the most demand, things were pretty good. So one magistrate in 1818 wrote,
"Some years ago, the weavers were so extravagantly paid that they could work 3 or 4 days in the week, spend a great deal of their time and money in alehouses, while at home their tea tables are laden twice a day with rum and the finest bread and butter."
Which makes me think two things. Firstly, what was he complaining about? He was a magistrate. I don't suppose under the factory system they were made to get up at 5 in the morning and go to a justice factory in time for the hooter and sit for 16 hours at a summing up machine with cases whizzing past while they went, "Clearly this is a case of gross neglect on the side of the plaintiff. I find for the prosecution sentence the accused to 40 hours community service." But also, I bet these weavers were a pain in the arse. They were probably in the pub every night.
Oh, here comes Flash Wally the weaver.
No. "Why, who wants to come outside and see the new horse, eh? Hey, lovely she is. Look at that twin saddle, jacked up tail. Of course you couldn't afford her. I'll tell you what, Stan, I'll buy you a drink. I'm rolling in it. Right, I'll have a mead for all these and a mead top for the ladies."
The most hated people in society seemed to be the millers. Most people relied on bread, but millers had a reputation for filling loaves with dust and fiddling the weight. And most of them also had a reputation for trying to get off with the girls that went to the mill to collect the bread. So a popular rhyme in the 1790s went,
"A brisk young lass, so brisk and gay, went unto the mill one day. Come sit you down, you sweet pretty dear. I cannot grind your corn, I fear. My stones is high and my water low. I cannot grind, for the mill won't go." Then she sat down all on a sack. They talked of this and they talked of that. They talked of love proved kind, and she soon found out that his mill would grind.
And do you know, a similar joke turned up 190 years later on the Russ Abbott Show. Every aspect of this lifestyle was to be thrown into disarray by the Industrial Revolution, and the craftsmen couldn't compete. There were at least 500,000 weavers in Britain at the time, and over a 30-year period, their average wage went from 20 shillings a week down to 5 shillings. Suddenly, society had a different set of rules. The manufacturers took their new ethics from a book called The Wealth of Nations, which the Scottish economist Adam Smith had written in 1776. Smith wrote that there was an invisible hand in the free market which worked to everybody's benefit. So he said,
"It is not from the benevolence of the butcher or brewer or baker that we expect our dinner."
So the free market should decide what price items should be sold at and what wages should be paid to workers. To the manufacturers, Smith's book was gospel. It was as if they were saying, "Well, I'd like to pay you more, but it's out of my hands, isn't it? I mean, I'll have the invisible hand of the free market onto me, won't I?" "I mean, that's more than my job's worth, mate. Nothing I can do about it, sorry." The factory system also created a division of labour. Each worker was an expert only on his one part of production rather than on the whole process as before, which was a big advantage for the industrialist, because when the person you're talking to has got all the skills, you're in a very weak negotiating position, as anybody knows who's ever been to a car mechanic. When they humiliate you by saying things like, "Is the thermostat working?" "I'll go for it, 50-50. "No." "How'd you get down here then?" But now, instead of the centre of production being a human being, it was a machine. Every moment the machine wasn't operating was seen by the employer as lost money. A doctor from Leeds said,
"While machines work, the people must work. Men, women and children are yoke fellows with iron and steam."
In other words, humans were no longer human, but one part of a machine, which meant every aspect of life changing. For one thing, it meant changing the whole perception of time. Craftsmen who previously thought of work as something which just had to be completed by Saturday just couldn't understand the idea of turning up and finishing at exactly the same time every day. Because when you think about it, it is the most stupid way to get anything done. Nobody who wants to do anything useful does it the factory way. If you want to wash your car, you don't force yourself to start at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning with a stinking hangover, and then every time you stop say, "Come along, I'm not paying you to look at the sponge, you know." And then if you stop for a cup of tea, wait until you've had exactly 10 minutes break going, "Well, I'd be a fool to myself to start back early." So a whole generation had to be taught the importance of getting in on time, especially as most people didn't own a clock. One of the main purposes of Sunday school was to teach kids to arrive on time. Worst of all was that children were just small parts of this machine. A parliamentary committee in 1816 admitted that 7-year-olds were commonly working 15-hour days in cotton mills, stood up for the whole time. A Mr. Giddy, who was president of the Royal Society, was in favour of child labour because
giving education to the labouring classes of the poor would be prejudicial to their happiness. It would teach them to despise their lot in life and render them insolent to their superiors.
And the conditions. The town of Manchester was described in 1814 by a German traveller as
"No sun and no dust. A dense cloud of smoke covers the sun and turns the dust into paste."
And I bet there were still loads of 20-year-olds in Manchester going,
"Yeah, but it's a really happening scene up here, right? Because we got this band together, right? Only the audience couldn't see us because of black paste, right? So we just turned on power loom and everyone started dancing to that."
The policy of the government over this time was directed by two emotions, hope and fear. Hope from Britain's newfound wealth and corresponding status in the world with its empire, and fear that the lower orders would rise up and take some of this wealth for themselves. The most popular hero of that period was Tom Paine. He wrote a book called The Rights of Man, which defended the French Revolution and proposed that England should be a democracy with a welfare state and education for all. So thousands of people learnt to read, especially to read The Rights of Man, and throughout the country groups would meet secretly to discuss the book. So Paine's lucky his publisher wasn't like the modern kind.
"Tom, mate, sit down. I've read your text, and I think we've got something here, I really do. Just a couple of things, sir. This chapter about the poor creating the wealth, could we make it more about football?"
A law was passed making it illegal to own a copy, and Paine had to flee for his life to France. But the famous dissidents were yet to come. The Luddites. The word Luddite has come to mean anybody who opposes new technology. For example, if a train's been stood in a station for 1 minute and you're the only one not going, "Hi, look, I'm going to be a minute late, OK?" Then someone will go, "Oh, haven't you got a mobile, Luddite?" So most people's perception of the Luddites is that they were just anti-technology mad.
Right, that were right good neat of breaking things modern with that. There'll be no more turnips in this town.
Aye, put kettle on.
Thar's a traitor if I does. That's work of devil, is kettle. Give it here.
Hey, here.
Right. Now, if folk want warm tea, thar can breathe on it for 2 days and make it warm without machinery.
In fact, the Luddites weren't against new technology at all. They were just against it being introduced in such a way as to leave them starving. Nor at first were they violent. For a long time, croppers tried to prevent mass use of the shearing frame by invoking a statute of Edward VI, which made their use illegal. Also, the parliamentary system of the time didn't leave a great deal of room for the letters to your MP style of campaigning. Cornwall had 44 MPs. London had 10. Manchester, which was the second biggest town in the country, had none. And the borough of Old Sarum, which consisted of one farmhouse, had 2. So presumably in Old Sarum, there was one vote, the farmer. And I bet even there, if the Tory got in, he'd go, well, I didn't vote for him. The way the new machinery was introduced was leaving craftsmen with no control over their work, a third of their wages, and wrecking their families, and all their appeals and petitions were being ignored. So cloth workers in Nottingham formed opposition societies and took oaths, pledging to keep secret the identities of other oath-takers. The first recorded Luddite incident came on the night of November the 4th, 1811, at Bulwell, near Nottingham. A group of men, armed with axes and swords, marched to the house of a master weaver and destroyed his frames. Now, that week, a declaration of intent to break machines was etched on a copper plate, the order coming from King Ned Ludd. Nobody knows for certain why this name Ludd was chosen, but there never was a Ned Ludd. At that point, raids started taking place almost every night. Thousands of troops were moved into the area and hundreds of spies. So during a raid on Rawfold's Mill, the owner Cartwright and some soldiers ambushed the Luddites and shot 4 of them. 2 were dead, but 2 were just wounded. They were then refused medical aid unless they revealed the name of the local Luddite leaders. At which point a priest was brought in to the wounded Luddites to get the names that the mill owners wanted. The priest told the men, who knew by now that they were dying, that God would redeem them only if the wounded Luddites divulged the names. He wouldn't tell the mill owners, he promised. It was just for God. So for several days the priest sat there waiting for these names from the wounded Luddites, until eventually one of the Luddites did call the priest over. Yes, yes, what is it? Said the priest. And the Luddite groaned, tell me, can you keep a secret? Yes, yes, of course I can, said the priest. Good, said the Luddite. So can I, and died with his next breath. The third area affected by Luddism was Lancashire, main home of the weavers. In Stockport, a march to demolish manufacturer John Goodair's steam-powered looms was led by men dressed as women, calling themselves Ned Ludd's wives. And a giant effigy of King Ludd was made and paraded around the county with huge numbers turning out to show support. His head was a giant turnip, he wore white corduroy trousers, a French Revolution liberty cap, and he was stuffed with straw and, according to his makers,
a large carrot between his legs, making him truly a king.
Then 2 weeks later, a merchant who'd lost £8,000 on a deal in Russia, for which he blamed the British authorities, stood by Parliament, waited for Prime Minister Spencer Percival, and shot him. But what was worse for the authorities than a dead Prime Minister was the reaction. Carnivals were then held all round the country. Thousands then turned up to cheer the assassin, John Bellingham, when he was hung. And the government, as a result of this, believed that the country was now on the point of revolution. Over 14,000 troops were then sent to Luddite areas, and almost every pub in Nottingham, Yorkshire and Lancashire had its own spy. Though from what you hear in pubs, that must have left the authorities completely confused.
Ah, Smithers, have you completed your report?
Indeed, ma'am. At the King's Arms, on 3 consecutive nights, one man told me, and I quote, I was his very best friend, a real diamond, and that the 1971 Arsenal team was the best side he'd ever seen.
The troops and spies were unable to stop the machine breaking, but they did arrest a batch of Lancashire Luddites, hanging 10 and transporting others to Australia. Luddism was sent into crisis. Spasmodic moments of Luddism did return from time to time, but after another series of hangings, its day was passed to be derided 180 years later as unthinking, disorganised and backward. But were they really that primitive? They left alone the machines of the employers who ran compensation schemes, so it wasn't just the machines that they hated. And many Luddites were in jobs that weren't directly affected by those machines. And their demands were that craftsmen made unemployed by technology should be compensated, that they should be given a chance to retrain, and that funds, i.e. taxes, should provide a safety net for the poorest victims, which is why it's right to say the Luddites were amongst the most forward-looking people of their time. As Luddism receded, many ex-Luddites joined the growing campaign for the vote. Petitions and meetings were organised around the country, culminating in a massive rally at St Peter's Field in Manchester in 1819. 60,000 people came to hear reformer Henry Hunt address the crowd, but the magistrates who ran Manchester called for the local yeomanry to ride into the crowd with sabres. Amidst the screaming and the panic, hundreds were wounded and 14 people were killed, although witnesses did confirm the escape of one man, because he'd bought a huge cheese on the way to the demonstration and put it under his hat for safekeeping. So when a yeoman attacked him with a sabre, he brought the sabre down onto his head, but it got stuck in the cheese. You must have thought, thank God we haven't got brie in this country. The day became known as the Battle of Peterloo, and such was the national mood afterwards that just after Henry Hunt was released from jail, Henry Hunt's horse died, and another 60,000 turned up for the horse's funeral. Two memorable poems followed this, The Mask of Anarchy by Shelley, and a shorter one by Byron, which he wrote when the Foreign Secretary of the time, Castlereagh, committed suicide.
Posterity will ne'er survey a nobler grave than this. Here lie the bones of Castlereagh. Stop, traveller, and piss.
Eventually, the continuing campaign of opposition led to grudging reforms, but the period of the Industrial Revolution had managed two remarkable achievements. Firstly, it transformed the production of every item in society. It created ways of producing the same goods as before in one-tenth of the time. It enabled crowds of people to be fed from the labour of a handful of farmers. It built modern roads in the place of dirt tracks, canals in the place of donkeys, and railways in the place of the canals. But the other achievement was that it took all these extraordinary innovations, which had the potential to enrich mankind in a way never thought possible, and use them to create utter wretched misery. So is there anything positive we can take from their times at all for our times? There is the spirit and the tenacity of those like the Luddites and the crowd at Peterloo, but there is also the story of William Huxon. For William Huxon was the Home Secretary whose crowning glory was to be that he was going to open the first public railway from Liverpool to Manchester. This he was convinced would make him a celebrity and a name to be remembered. So on the day of the opening, the train stopped on its maiden journey so that William Huxon, halfway from Liverpool to Manchester, could get out of the train and wave to the crowds. So he got out, began waving, and walked along the track. At which point, the train started up by mistake and knocked him down dead. So you never know when Mandelson walks in to open that dome.
The Mark Steele Revolution was written and presented by Mark Steele with the help of Martin Heider and Carla Mendonca. The producer was Phil Clark.